Lord and God, may we know you more clearly, love you more dearly, and follow you more nearly, day by day. Amen. There are plenty of things in life that you and I give ourselves to, aren't there? Lots that we give our time, our energy, our money, and our thoughts to that are pretty non-consequential, simply necessary, and just the kind of everyday life. And then there are the things that we give ourselves to that are more existential, central to who we are, the core drivers of what gives me and you our true sense of significance and happiness. Our species has a perpetuality to look to something or someone to provide us with our fundamental significance and happiness, don't we? This is often what absorbs your heart and captures your imagination above all, is normally what we absolutely can't do without, deeply scares us not to have, and sees us setting our life up and around obtaining and preserving whatever it may be. We look to this thing or this person to ultimately lead us to that good place of significance and happiness that we seek. Today, it is seeing and holding God as the one we look to as enough to provide this, which is what we're going to see in the wrestle of Israel in the next chapter of 1 Samuel. So firstly, chapter 7, God is the great king. The lost ark has been returned to Israel, and it's been 20 years since that awful day of defeat, the Battle of Ebenezer. Since then, the Philistines have come to live deep within Israel's borders, and they continue to creep further in. They remain this ever-looming threat. And the Philistines are well on their way to establishing themselves permanently in Israel's patch. But a moment for Israel arrives, building over time through Samuel's ministry, a change among God's people is afoot, a return to the Lord, a return to the Lord. And Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, if you are returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then rid yourself of the foreign gods and the Asherites and commit yourself to the Lord and serve him only. And he'll deliver you out of the hands of the Philistines. So the Philistines put away their Baals and Asherites and served the Lord only. Samuel calls the Israelites to show the genuineness of their heart and the seriousness of their all by putting away the gods that they had put first in their lives and putting God back as number one. They'd given themselves to these gods to provide their security, build their identity, and create that sense of national dignity. These good things, these significant and happy things, are what they've been longing for and what they've been struggling to obtain since entering the land. But the Lord had promised to provide Israel with all these good things, and actually more, really. These would be enjoyed as they trusted the Lord and him only, and expressed that trust in obedience, lived a life of worship, really. You see, Israel had moved away from fully trusting in God by bringing in deities from outside Israel that they could see, that they could touch, almost taste, that they hoped in to deliver this. Yet this adding, well, it only taken away from solely living a life of faith in God, being the special people that they were to be, those out of and unlike the rest of the world, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, those who love the Lord their God with all their hearts, with all their soul, and with all their strength, and to have his commands on their hearts, where they received his good. But now, Israel realizing this, if they're returning to the Lord, as Samuel says, they are to get rid of the idols, commit to the Lord, serve him only. How Israel behaves, their obedience, will show ultimately if God is enough, if God is number one. That will validate their repentance and show their faith as genuine. So Israel gather to give corporate expression to their sin and their failure. It's a wonderful moment of actually returning to the Lord with all their heart, isn't it? And it's a great opportunity for the Philistines to end Israel in one foul swoop for good. It gets serious very suddenly. This is a testing. Israel are looking down upon the pointy end of their extinction event. What will they do? They've put all their eggs in one basket with the Lord. They're all in, and they're wildly vulnerable because of it. They're trusting everything to God. It's going to happen. Will he come through on his promises for them? It's the first time, isn't it, in a long time that Israel are not hedging their bets when it comes to life and spirituality. Will the people cry out? Samuel intercedes. He sacrifices for them. And the Lord answers. A rescue. We see a rescue take place. The Lord is there to help his people. With battle lines drawn up, the Lord leads the charge on Israel's behalf. He engages the enemy and single-handedly puts them to flight. He thunders from heaven. Shadows fall, clouds churn thick, the sky goes dark, and boom after boom rings out at a deafening volume, ringing the ears and thumping the chest with echoes rumbling around the hills. Line after line of the enemy ranks shudder and cower at such an attack. Pandemonium breaks out across the army and the Philistines scatter. Yahweh, the Lord, the God of Israel, thunders. And we hear some of Hannah's song from chapter 1, don't we? Rise up through the claps of thunder. He will thunder against them from heaven, and the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He brings about a comprehensive victory, and it's astonishing. All Israel does is kind of conduct Operation Mop-Up after the battle is won. And so we see how the Lord totally exerts his authority over the so-called storm god, Baal and his Asherah, using thunder. I love the veiled humor and kind of irony of this situation. God uses the very means of rescue of what this God is supposed to be about to show his supremacy over false gods of the surrounding nations. It's great. And so actually at the time renders any allegiance to these beliefs as futile. Shows impossible to fill the promise of these deities and to provide that life and that legacy and that abundance that they're striving for. And, you know, I think that has something to ultimately say to other spiritual beliefs and practices outside of Christianity, to what they really can offer for our significance and our happiness. But be sure to note this. Write it down. The Lord is the one who defeats Israel's enemies, reestablishes those lost borders, gives Israel peace, protection, and a distinctiveness compared to other people that's of great worth. He is all they need and the one to look to give them what they need. This event shows you and I and all Israel, the Lord is the undisputed sovereign. He is the great king, the king of Israel and supreme over the nations and even their deities. And it reminds Israel once again who the Lord is and of the relationship that they are to have with him. It's simple. It's amazing. But the truth is this. The Lord's rescue and all the benefits that come with that is experienced when his people trust him and live that faith out in obedience. That's it. So their return are rescued and a restoration takes place. To mark the moment, Samuel builds what is like a memorial, but instead of it serving to remember the names of the fallen, its purpose is to provide a memorial to the memory of God's mercy and salvation. Ebenezer, the stone, the name of it, it shows the astonishing victory enjoyed when his people are all in heart and soul with the Lord, their king. And that was what lacked at the battleground of Ebenezer those 20 years before. See what's going on there? The name of the stone, Ebenezer, put here at Mizpah, states that decisive reversal of that great failure and all they've lost. But this stone of help also, and importantly, calls to memory the many, many points of their history of the Lord's help. His help to Abraham in Egypt, the wilderness, Joshua, Judges, just for starters. And at the same time, this stone states the Lord's help into the future, as has always been the case and will be. Israel are to live lives of trust displayed in obedience, worship really, in light of the great king's merciful rescue as they enjoy being his special people. Lest they forget that. And St. George's, lest we forget that. It's a cause of remembrance for you and for myself. The same truth at a later time. There is an Ebenezer that we must recall, keep close to our hearts to live now as the people of this great king. A day up a hill where one faithful Israelite, surrounded by all those who had made themselves his enemy, he was giving expression of his trust in the Lord as he cried out, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." It was on their behalf, offering forgiveness and a return to the Lord for a wayward people, a humanity that had forgotten. At his intercession, at the moment of his sacrifice, he hung there. The sky went dark, the sun disappeared, the earth shook, and the rocks split. The people shuddered. He thundered. And once again, the rescue of God was seen. This time, the final and the greatest of victories. We see Jesus the Christ, God's King, leads the battle against our greatest enemy. He devastatingly routs humanity's enemies that held sway and had taken over, pursuing them all the way to the grave, driving sin away, defeating death, and disarming the devil. And so he's the one able to restore to us all the good that we had lost. And so, for those of you who have turned in faith and obedience to Jesus Christ, the cross becomes our Ebenezer. That's worth writing down. It's worth singing about. At the cross, we see God's generous help to sinners. We raise up the cross and we say, "Thus far, the Lord has helped us." And if he's helped us by giving his own son, then surely he will bring us safely home to glory. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us, how will he not also along with him graciously give us all things? The hymn, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, contains the lines, here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. You return first to the Lord by getting rid of what is stopping you, turning to Jesus with all your heart. You commit to the Lord and you serve him only. That is, you repent and you have faith. And yes, it is a vulnerable position that you're in, being all in heart and soul. But that's how you experience the Lord's rescue and all the blessings that come with that. That doesn't change. Life with God continues to be one of trust, where we are tempted to bring in other things to deliver what we feel we lack, what we need, what isn't being provided by God. When that happens, look to the cross. When we're scared, when we feel hopeless, like a failure, look to the cross. Put all your eggs in that basket, yeah? This day of rescue is what reminds us, calls us back to be all in, and provides for us the way of return, rescue, and restoration. Our Ebenezer is where we can stand in view of God's mercy and so offer our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God, as this is our spiritual act of worship, and where we know help to not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but become transformed by the renewing of our minds, able to test and approve what God's will is, his good and pleasing and perfect will. God is the great King. But, chapter 8, we need another king. As the curtains close on chapter 7, all is well. Now, as the curtains open on chapter 8, we see things have changed. It is time for Samuel's handover, the transition to new leadership. You can feel the difference. So who's going to take the people forwards? Well, Samuel's got a good plan. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel. The name of his secondborn was Abijah. And they served at Bathsheba. But his sons did not walk in the ways of the Lord. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. Hang on. Two wayward sons of Israel's priests. It's history repeating itself. This is a face plant moment. Now, seeing this, Israel gets together and brings their request. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you're old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint to us a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. Now underline that phrase because it's important. Let me continue. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, listen to all the people that are saying to you, it's not that they've rejected you, but they've rejected me as their king, as they've done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they're doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. A king. This is new. Israel's never had a king before. It's an historical moment. You can feel that difference, right? Faced with Samuel's choice of leadership and not wanting, I suppose, to risk going back to the mess and something of the madness of Eli's sons, it seems eminently sensible to request a king. After all, God has actually allowed it. In Deuteronomy 17, God made provision for Israel to have a king. When they had come into the land, he spelled out the characteristics of the type of king they were to have. When they wanted one, they seem to have pressed that button. So it can't be that. So what is it? Well, it's demanding a king such as all the other nations have. That's what you underlined. A king that they go on to say they want to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles. They're asking, though, for the wrong kind of king, aren't they? And that shows they're asking for the wrong reasons. They demand out of fear, not faith. It's like the idolatry of chapter 7 that they had turned from, but with a different twist. They wanted to bring in a king of their choosing, not a deity of their choosing. It's a monarch, not a god. When faced again with the uncertain prospect of their security, their identity, their sense of nation, this is their solution. This time there's no calling to God and asking for his help. They want to bring a king in to provide any help that they need. And to their minds, this is the way to get it. But this is the problem. God is their great king. We just saw clearly who is king, right? You see the irony? God literally went before them and fought their battle in the previous chapter. As one preacher says, they were not to trust in the size of their army for security or to be constantly and fervishly trying to accomplish in order to establish their identity and give them a sense of meaning. Their relationship with God was supposed to be the source of those things. Remember, this is what made them totally different from all the other nations. What set them apart, makes them salt and light and a city on a hill, having the Lord as their great king. Living a life of faith in him, expressed in obedience, was what fundamentally defined them compared to other people. A kingdom of priests, a holy nation. That is what's transformed. Conforming to the ways of the world wouldn't add to that one bit. It would only take away. And that's what defines God's people today, doesn't it? Us, St. George's. Peter says to us, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful life. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Yet in Israel's past and at this request, we don't see them walking out on God altogether. That's not what they're doing, is it? It's not really quite the case that we see here. It's just they seem to want more. Their request shows something really important. God as their king doesn't seem enough. Once again, by looking to the world and what it offers, they're dividing their heart. And God considers this a rejection of him. It's another moment in their history where they fail to trust him. So 10 a.m., I want to ask you, where have you done this? Where have you said, God, you're not enough? Sure, God is great. Jesus is my king. Of course. But I need something more to ensure my significance and my happiness. What have you given yourself to as the value add to your relationship with God? Maybe you've said, God is great. Jesus is my king. But give me some concrete things to do. Give me a sense of achievement and respect as I'm seeing doing them. Make sure there is the right religious elements in the Sunday service for me. Give me that position on parish council. Keep me involved in important church goings on. So you're asking to be useful and to contribute, and that's not wrong. It's good. What's wrong is that you demand that kind of thing from fear, not faith. Fear that without your concrete input or what you do, the quality and the stability of your faith and your standing in the community will fade and become lost. Or God, I trust you, but I've got to see some career advancement, decent uni degree, successful ministry, promotions like other people. It's okay to ask for those things. But if you simply can't be happy without good work prospects before you, professional progression, higher pay, that shows that you'll be motivated by fear. I can never feel happy, feel secure, or reach my potential until I'm at this qualification, this level of income, this position of significance. Or maybe you've said, God, you must give me healthy, good, intellectual kids, a loving spouse, a house in a nice suburb, and a cute dog as well. Give me the family lifestyle that looks like this. There's nothing wrong with wanting to enjoy a stable, wholesome whole family. But when that's driven by fear, then I'll never be satisfied and never feel adequate enough without it until I match up with all the other families that have arrived there. You see, 10 a.m., whatever the thing is that you demand in addition to God is your king. That is how you become like the Israelites in this chapter. I want you to pause and I want you to hear this because this is important for me and for you and for us as a church. Rejection of God is not usually walking away from God. It's usually demanding something in addition to God. Rejection of God is not usually walking away from God. It's usually demanding something in addition to God. What then might be the consequences of this choice, this king preference? Well, God tells Samuel to tell Israel what to expect from any king you demand in addition to God. And he double checks that this is really what they want for themselves. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. And he said, this is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and daughters and make them serve with his chariots and horses. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cookers and bakers. He'll take a tenth of your flocks and you yourselves will become his slaves. He will take. And in the end, it's going to lead to your enslavement. Your demand will end up demanding a great cost that one day you wish you never paid. Are you sure? This is a warning for us that the kings of this world that we demand, perhaps actual rulers of society or figuratively, such as good health, real success, true love, decent money, respect and acceptability, something of those examples before, won't simply fail to deliver on their promises. They actually end up enslaving us. Any king other than God that you give yourself to will exact from you, because without that king, there's no way to get the good that you're after. It will keep exacting from you. And so you'll work more hours, volunteer more time, spend more money, give more stuff, commit to more projects, give more of a say, give more attention and bend what is around you to move you ever closer to obtaining this goal, reaching this place. You'll double down on any losses along the way and excuse or justify the cracks that form in friendships, family, health, and character. And realize you're not giving the bottom of the barrel away. You're having the best of you taken, and you won't be able to get yourself out of it. The warning here, St. George's, is that every king but God enslaves. Whatever king you give your life to will take and take and take. Write that down. Circle it. Are you sure? Are you sure you want to give yourself to a king that operates like the world? Remember who you are. Remember who he is. Return. So the resolve. Well, they ask, they get, and we're left hanging, ready to hear in the next act just how much this king will take from them. But Israel needed a king different from the other nations, didn't they? They needed a king like God. And all of us need a king that we can safely give our all to that doesn't operate like this, don't we? It would be a while for Israel and the world, but it would be Jesus who would show himself to be Israel's king like this. Jesus was one utterly unlike those of the nations, who was the one who had said of himself, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." The true king did not come to be served, but to give and give and give, so those following his lead would experience freedom, not slavery. He could deliver the good the people feared they wouldn't get. When Pilate asked whether he is the king of the Jews, Jesus replied, "My kingdom is not of this world." That is what they needed. Yet God still wasn't enough, was he? The demand in this passage is, it's almost closed off by another demand that signals the climactic rejection of God. "Here is your king," Pilate said. But they shouted, "Take him away. Take him away. Crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. They still want a king like all the other nations. And that preference is shared by many, maybe still you, maybe you still now. Yet it was this rejection that led to Jesus giving his life under their treason, bearing their sin and their shame, mine too. So the good that we so long for can be enjoyed, so we'd know freedom from striving to obtain, have forgiveness and help given when we fail, and so can be truly safe. No other king can deliver that. It is God we finally see in his King Jesus that comes to rescue, and all the benefits that come with that is experienced when his people trust him and live that faith out in obedience. Is that enough for you? Amen.